Okay. So you will have noticed that while this is the 13th and final class in Daniel, after 12 previous classes, I changed the title slide. Okay, this is one and perhaps the most famous artist rendition of the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. Daniel 12 is about the end. Daniel 12 uses that word. There are questions about that end. Time is given in answer to those questions. And so there is no doubt that Daniel 12 brings us up in Daniel's prophecies to this final conflagration, which took place in September of 70 A.D. after some 3.5 years of outright war and unrest and rebellion on the Jews' part that even preceded that. This is a rather fanciful, since I've been there, understanding of what Mount Scopus would have looked like, but Titus very famously, Vespasian, occupied this high ground because it did look across the Kidron Valley and at Jerusalem itself, which is roughly portrayed, correctly in that it's on a rising hillside like that. Here, of course, is the Temple Mount and the temple itself, and so it has at least, a helpful rendition of a number of walls, a total of 3 walls that would eventually be breached. This is the conclusion of the book of Daniel. It is the conclusion, then, of a prophecy that we've already been studying for 2 weeks. Starting in Daniel chapter 10 and running through 11 and all the way to the end of the book at the conclusion of chapter 12, you really have one event. There are several, different stages, if you will. Now, Daniel is praying, and then you have a revelation of this man that is dressed in linen. It is an absolutely terrifying vision that befalls Daniel, and he's rendered, unconscious by it. Now, then he is given this information from other individuals that come to him about these wars of the various princes. It's fascinating information, but it gives us a glimpse behind the veil and behind the powers that be and the nations that have prominence and are at war with each other back in Daniel's time and in the times to come. But only enough so as to wet our whistles, we might say. We surely wish we knew more about this, but it is obviously information that is quite privileged. It is God's to know. He gives Daniel a little bit of insight into it, I think primarily just to give Daniel understanding of the enormity of the scope of what it is that he's going to be finding out about. It has to do with entire nations, the rise and fall of those nations, and ultimately the fall of his own nation. Behind it all, in the spirit realm, there are these princes at war, even as there are in this life armies that are at war. We are given in chapters 10 through 12, particularly starting right at the end of chapter 10 and then throughout 11, we are given the future history from 539 BC to 70 AD. That is the span of time that is covered in Daniel chapters 11 and 12. And it concludes then with this statement that there will be a shattering of the power of the holy people. There is but one idea that Daniel could possibly get from this. He is being given understanding and insight. If it is some other people than his own people, the Jews, well then, of course, something would have been said. But it isn't. We're not talking about the end of Christianity. We're not talking about the end of all world powers at a final judgment. It has not yet befallen this universe. But it is the shattering of Daniel's people, the holy people of God, who are the Jews, under that covenant, who and will be under that covenant for another 600 years. So that's the thrust of all of this. 10, 11, and 12 spans 539 BC. The end of Daniel's life is upon him, all the way down to 70 AD, where you have the shattering of the power of the holy people. Now, I've been kind of holding this little chart for a little while. I've been thinking about showing it to you the last couple of weeks. Just hadn't done it yet, but I discovered this a few weeks ago. It's the best representation I've seen of these two great empires that you find throughout Daniel 11. Kings of the north, which are the Seleucids, and the kings of the south, which are the Ptolemies. So everything you see in yellow here which is centered in what we would call modern-day Syria, and it was called that even in those days. You know, all of this area right here is the Seleucid Empire that is the kings of the north. Then you have in the gray down here, so northern Africa, Arabian Peninsula, and all this, you have the kings of the south, the Ptolemies. You have two very prominent dynasties, north and south, who are at war with each other, and their princes are at war with each other. And so we have events unfolding for a couple of hundred years in the Medo-Persian Empire, and then in the Grecian Empire, and then in the split of the Grecian Empire four different ways, resulting finally in this state that we have between these two. Now, I've handed out on actually what's becoming numerous occasions, I think, in the course of the last several years in different contexts, this little chart that I've handed out yet again here this evening. And so if you didn't get one this evening, please make sure you do before you leave. I have some here at my podium. There are some out there in the foyer on that little table as well. It is altogether unchanged except for one thing. Down at the bottom right there, as you look at it, and now I'm going to blow that area up onto the screen right here. All I did was realize that after our class last week, I had room at the bottom of the chart to add that note that we spent so much time on last week. So it reads like this. Philip Malraux, in his book, a magnificent work, free, you can get the PDF online if you look for it. Malraux, spelled M-A-U-R-O. I still think it's the best commentary on these chapters that is to be found. Philip Malraux, in his book, The 70 Weeks and the Great Tribulation, first written in 1921, so in 3 years it'll be 100 years old, argues, he does, persuasively I think, that the king of chapter 11, verses 36 through 39, is Herod the Great. He sees Herod in chapter 11, verses 44 and 45 as well. Malraux says that when the Hasmoneans, we also know them as the Maccabees, are introduced in chapter 11, verses 31 through 35, that then the Jews really become the focus of this historical time frame. Of course, we know absolutely so that by the time you get into chapter 12, immediately after the verses that have just been named, it's certainly the Jews that we're talking about. So, he says the Jews become the focus of this historical time frame. Yes, Octavian, also known as Augustus, is the topic in 11, verses 40 through 43. But the overall view is still about Palestine, about Israel, and about the Jews. And so I've added in the bold there, I think he's right. So all I'm suggesting is, it is identical, everything above that note, what you had in the past, I just added that note. But if you'd like to just, you know, throw the old one away and replace it with this one, then you'll understand that in chapter 11, there's no doubt at the end, we've come down to the days of the Roman Empire. We're talking about Augustus, also known as Octavian, you know, certainly. But in the midst of that, apparently, is at least, you know, a likely candidate, Herod, is in view, because we are coming down now to this time of the end that is the conclusion as well of this great book of Daniel. So, if you will then open up your Bibles to Daniel in chapter 12. We're not going to go back into 10 or 11 at all. We're just going to start now with Daniel, the 12th chapter. At that time. That time has brought us down to the time of the Roman kings and to the time of the Herodian dynasty. I don't take the expression at that time to mean Tuesday, you know, on May 31st. It is the general time frame of those kings, first introduced in chapter 2. They are seen again in chapter 7. Not so much at 8 because we have just the two Medo-Persian and Greeks there. But, you know, it's that time frame, down to the time of the coming of the Messiah, who is so prominent in in Daniel chapter 9. So in verse 1, at that time, Michael, the great prince, here's these wars still going on, who stands over the sons of your people, the future generations of the Jews, Daniel's people, will rise, and there will be a time of distress, such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. Now, with this first verse, we've got a really prominent, obvious, undeniable, I think unshakable certainty that this great distress can be identified in history. There will be a time of distress, he said, such as never occurred since there was a nation. What nation? The nation of the Jews, your people. Never in their history until that time. So whatever it is that's coming in Daniel chapter 12, it is worse than anything they've ever seen. Have they seen Nebuchadnezzar and the complete destruction of their city and their temple? Yes, they have. But when they saw that, they also had Jeremiah to tell them that that was only going to last for a very specific number of years. How many years was that? 70 years. There's hope. They knew before it ever struck that it would be awfully bad. They also knew that it would be temporary, though 70 years is a long time, and that then there'd be a remnant and they'd be coming back and they, you know, would be established once more. So there was hope then. There won't be any hope in the remainder of Daniel now, as we turn to 10, 11, and 12. This time of distress is like never before, and it is going to be the ultimate end of the people. So we've been over this so many times in our Revelation studies in Matthew 24. I'm going to leave this largely to, leaning on past discussions. But in Luke chapter 21, which is the companion in Luke's Gospel to the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24. He says, Jesus says, just in the same generation these events will take place, 40 years before, he says in about 30 AD, there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. Well, this is really the only possible explanation for what Daniel's talking about. He's led them through all the intervening centuries of what we call the period between the Testaments. He's taken us down through the coming of the Roman Empire. In chapter 9, he's told us about the coming of the Christ and his crucifixion. Now he's saying that subsequent to these things, there's going to be a distress upon the land of these people that you've never seen before, and a wrath that's going to fall upon them that Jesus confirms when he adds in verse 32, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So this great distress, which is the same term that's being used, in Daniel, Jesus confirms is going to take place in the generation that he's talking to, which is obviously the same generation that Daniel 11 delivered us to. So this is just clear. It's a certain. It's not even a milepost. It's something far bigger than that. It's a mountain. It's a geographic, marker. It's immovable. This has to be that great distress. Now, that's 12:1, the first part. Here's the second part. At that time, the same time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. Now, I grant, this is a lot of verses right here, but nonetheless, I'm going to give you 11 passages and even more verses than that. First in the Old Testament, and then as you see in the New Testament, I'd strongly recommend you might want to grab a piece of paper, and jot this down. But all of these passages have to do with that book, having your name written in what elsewhere is called the Book of Life. In the Old Testament, it appears five times. The first time is in Exodus, chapter 32, verses 32 and 33. The next time is in Psalms, chapter 69, verse 28. It appears in Isaiah, chapter 4, verses 2 through 6. It's here in Daniel 12:1 and Malachi 3:16.
It's not Daniel 12:16. It's something
Not 16. It's supposed to be a B. It's a stylized B. I'm sorry. I see it looks now like a 16, but it's B. 12-1B. Yeah, I had A on the first one, so yeah, it's just the font I chose. So in 12-1B, we have this new book. And then in the New Testament, this book comes up again. It comes up in Luke chapter 10, verses 19 and 20. It's in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 3. It's in Revelation chapter 3, verse 5, chapter 13, verse 8, chapter 20, verses 12 and 15, and then in Revelation 21, verses 22 through 27. So there's really no doubt, Old Testament or New, your name's written in this book. You don't want your name to ever be blotted out of this book, and this book is a list of the names of everyone, Old Testament or New, who has ever successfully served their God and will be received by Him graciously into eternity. So, this book's been around a very long time. It is the Book of Life. Now, I preached a whole sermon on this here a year ago or whenever it was. So, again, I just give you the list, and you can look all these passages up yourself. But these people are going to be rescued. Now, again, trading on previous classes, Matthew 24, Revelation, you know, these people who are written in the book will be rescued. Leaves us to wonder, are they rescued spiritually and eternally at the end of the world? Or are they rescued physically and therefore temporarily, because they're still going to die someday, at the time when these events are taking place and in the time frame that's being described in Daniel 12? Well, it's not the end of the world in Daniel 12. It's the end of the holy people, but not the end of the planet. It's not talking about a spiritual salvation at the end of the world. It's talking about what Jesus was talking about in Matthew 24 and also in Luke. I used Luke's passage a moment ago instead of Matthew 24, same event. It's talking about a people who are told that there's an abomination of desolation coming. It's going to leave your people, it's going to leave your house desolate, the way Jesus put it. And when He says these things are going to happen there, you can be rescued from this certain destruction and captivity and suffering if you'll flee the city when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. So we've done all that study before. I'll be frustrating the people listening on the recordings now, I know, but you can look up, you know, these other classes. You can call me if you like. You know, I'm readily available, 360-652-6009. That's my phone number. Give me a ring, 360-652-6009. Discuss, you know, all this at length with anybody that you like. But I believe that this is physically rescued. Their lives will be saved. If those days had not been cut short, no life would have been saved. Those days were cut short. And they were told, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, run for the hills. Pray it's not in the winter. Be hopeful that you're not pregnant. You know, and you got all these problems because it's a physical escape so that you can save your physical life. But who are the only people that are going to accept Jesus' instruction and then abandon their homes, their businesses, and everything and run off into the hills? The people whose names are written in the Book of Life. The people who have accepted Jesus as not just a prophet who can foretell the future, but, you know, the Son of God and King of Israel, as Nathanael figured out early on, John chapter 1. So, I know that's just, you know, the barest bones of an overview, but we flesh this out in very great detail, you know, in other times. So, Daniel 12, 1b, there's no doubt, we know the time frame, can't be any other time frame. We have Jesus confirming it, and you'll see a good deal more confirmation of that as we go through the rest of this evening. So that brings us to Daniel 12 and verse 2. Here's another, and this will be the second, really maybe of three or four, but we've got, you know, some big questions to answer again. Many. Is the word many spelled A-L-L? Oh, pretty obviously not. It doesn't say all. It says many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, and these to everlasting life, but the others, whether or not they're awake, we're not told yet. They will eventually, but whether or not it's the same awakening, this verse doesn't say,
but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. So many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground, sounds like they are what? It's a trick. It sounds like they are dead, but does it say spiritually or physically? Those words are not there. Clearly, it's an image of death, but you're right to then ask, what kind of death? The Bible is full of spiritual death. It's also full of physical death. Which death are we talking about? These are people who sleep in the dust of the ground. So I'd suggest very seldom, and not likely Daniel's, first conclusion is, oh, he must be talking about sin. When you read that expression, sleeping in the dust of the ground, what does that first call to mind? Physically dead, because they're buried. That's the first thing that comes to mind. It could refer to the others, I'll show you in a moment, but just note, it doesn't say. The expression is, they sleep in the dust of the ground, and they will awake. These to everlasting life, others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. So we have to now start searching the scriptures to see if we can identify this event in the time of the Roman Empire, subsequent to the crucifixion of Christ, and prior to the shattering of the power of the holy people, we'll be reading about in a minute, because that's the furthest terminus in Daniel's book. He doesn't talk about anything after the end of the Jewish people unless this would be it. So we have to ask ourselves, what is that talking about? Now, one man suggests, and after I've just touted Philip Mauro as highly as I possibly can, here's his idea, for instance, many others, but he also has this in his book. He says, well, for instance, take a look at Isaiah 29:10. The Lord has poured over you a spirit of deep sleep. He has shut your eyes, the prophets, and he's covered your heads, the seers. So here we've got people who are in a deep sleep. Up here we have people who are sleeping. In this deep sleep, this is something the Lord has done. And how did the Lord do it? What did he do? He took the prophets away. Now, the Jews themselves will confirm, did throughout all the writing between the Testaments in those 400 years, there are no prophets. They know that's the case, and certainly they don't have any in our Bibles either. So maybe what we're talking about is something along those lines, the end of prophecy. Or maybe in Ephesians 5 it says, all things become visible when they are exposed by the light. For everything that becomes visible is light. For this reason it says, awake, and wake up here, sleeper, we had sleepers up here, and arise from the dead. Well, he had sleep in the dust, awake, so sounds similar, and Christ will shine on you. So what they're suggesting, and therefore I'm passing along to you, is that along with Ezekiel chapter 37, this may be referring to people who have blinded their eyes, you know, and won't believe the prophets, or the period of time when the prophets are gone, so, you know, we don't have any more. But either way, they would be an ignorant people, a benighted people. They don't know what the truth is, so they're not practicing yet. They're sleeping in the sense of a spiritual death, ignorance and sin. Now, in Ezekiel 37, by the way, what time frame is Ezekiel living in? He's in Babylon, just the same as Daniel. Daniel went in 606 B.C. Ezekiel goes in 597. So there's 9 or 10 years between the two, but now they're both in this same country. And so, as I pointed out in our introductory material, Daniel's been called a high power, influence, and authority in this kingdom. And he will, you know, for the succeeding Medo-Persians as well. Ezekiel isn't. Apparently, Ezekiel is the prophet to the people. Daniel is the prophet to the kings. He's up there in the palace, but Ezekiel's talking to the people. And it's famous, 37th chapter in the Valley of the Dry Bones prophecy. Verses 11 through 14, it says, he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel.
Behold, they say, our bones are dried up and our hope has perished. We are completely cut off. Therefore, prophesy and say to them, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will open your graves. So now we got people waking and coming out of death again. I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves, my people, and I will bring you into the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord, when I've opened your graves and caused you to come up out of your graves, my people. I will put my spirit within you. Well, there's a spiritual awakening for sure. You will come to life, and I will place you on your own land. Then you'll know that I, the Lord, have spoken and done it, declares the Lord. So in the Valley of the Dry Bones, we've got two things happening. We have the image of people dead and bones lying out in a field. They're not even buried. Then they all come back together again. And what that means is, I'm going to put my spirit within you. You're going to come out of your grave. You're going to live again. And secondly, I'm going to bring you back into your land. You're going to come back to your land. Now, all I've said is, it's a compelling argument. There are scriptures that certainly suggest this may be an image in Daniel 12 of a spiritual awakening, coming out of spiritual death, escaping somehow sin and ignorance so that you can believe the prophets and be a faithful servant of God. That has much to commend it. So, you take that view, I'm fine with that. My problem is, there is an alternate view, but I don't know really how to pick between the two. Now, I know you don't like this, but when I don't know, I can't tell you what I don't know. And so I'll show you what the options are, and you'll understand that you need to start your study now like everybody else. I've spent 40 years working this problem. You know, it's asked your turn. But let's see if we can't figure this out. There's more than one way to understand it. So looking again at this same verse 2, is exactly what I had up a moment ago. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. These to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Well, we've explored maybe that's a spiritual death and a spiritual awakening. But I'd like to call your attention to John 5, and again with this congregation I've done this before. In John 5 and verse 25, it says, Jesus says, an hour is coming. So it'd be future as he's speaking. But then he adds, and now is. So while it isn't here quite yet, it's really close. So there's an hour coming and now is. It's both coming and present. So we're in the immediate time frame. It just hasn't actually played out yet, he says. When the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. Not everybody's going to hear, but those who do hear will live. When the dead hear the voice of the Son of God, some of them are going to hear, and the some who hear will live. Now, I don't have time to get into it tonight, but after you get to verse 28 and following there, you're going to find out, he says, don't marvel at this. There's going to be another resurrection when all who are in the tombs will rise, both the evil and the good. So in Daniel 5, 25 through about 29, I think it is, you've got two resurrections. One of them's limited. The other one's universal. One of them, he says, is coming and now is. The second one, he just says, is coming. He doesn't suggest that it's close. There are two different resurrections. I'm pretty sure this one in verse 25 has to happen pretty soon because it's not only coming, but it now is. And the other one, I believe, is the general resurrection of both the evil and the good for a final judgment on all the earth, which hasn't happened yet. This one in 5:25 is different than that one in several ways, as I've shown you before. So, let me just lay on the table Matthew 27. That's Matthew 27, verses 50 through 53. Where it says, at the moment Jesus was crucified and declared that it is finished, the tombs were opened. And many, which is the term that Daniel used, not all, and which is suggestive of John 5's first part, first resurrection, not the second one, many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep
were raised. Can you hear echoes of Daniel 12:2? Well, sure you can. Then it says, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection. So they were raised, but they didn't show themselves. They didn't come out of the tombs for at least 3 days. After his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. So now I've got what I think are two very viable ways to understand Daniel 12. My problem is picking between the two, knowing that both of them can fit quite well into the Roman Empire's time frame of the Messiah's generation, when these Jews are going to go through their great distress, their tribulation, such as has never been, as Jesus confirms, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, all of that discourse will be in that generation. So, if I have to pick between these two, at this moment, I am strongly in favor, by about 51% certainty. That's the second one. I'd vote for that. But brethren, I'm not the least bit sure, you know, or certain. It's just pretty obviously to me that in Daniel 12, your first thought is physically dead if you're in the dust of the ground. And secondly, this awakening, some to everlasting life, others to disgrace and everlasting contempt, you know, is showing a partial resurrection. But it's an actual resurrection, a physical resurrection. For me, that fits better an actual resurrection in the sense of a physical resurrection that took place in Matthew 27, not long at all after Jesus spoke the words of John 5. Yes?
On the timing between John 5:25 and Matthew, it feels like that's way after.
The timing between John 5 and what?
Yeah,
physically, it could be as much as 3 years, something less maybe. So it's this time frame, but soon, as opposed to one that is in, going back to the latter part of John 5, it's unfair. We did it before, I didn't do it tonight on time. But latter part of John 5, there are two different resurrections for sure. One's limited, the other's not. Daniel's is limited, it's many, it's not all.
I always figured that the people who resurrected in Matthew 27 just lived a little while and died again.
Can't answer that question, can we?
I didn't ever think that they...
Everything that can be known about this event is on that screen right there. Unless Daniel mentioned it. Which to me is also in itself something of evidence to be considered. Daniel speaks of this resurrection, dust of the earth, coming alive. Okay? Matthew, Jesus, speaks of this resurrection. Clearly, dust of the earth, they're in tombs. Okay? Why would this exist, this statement in Matthew 27, if it has nothing to do with anything ever elsewhere? Looks to me like it's a direct tie to Daniel 12. And so we have Daniel predicting not only physical events in the sense of armies and countries and that sort of thing, but a resurrection from the dead. Those are real hard to predict. Ask me last week, will Brett Kavanaugh have a hard time in his examination to become Chief Justice? Now, with 100% certainty, what can I tell you? Yeah, it's going to be bad. Be glad you're not in his family. They're sure suffering. Okay, so that's great. But how about if I predict that 600 years from now there'll be a resurrection from the dead? It won't be everybody. It's not the general resurrection. It's just men. Okay?
You're just not going to let me get angry. But doesn't it say that there was an earthquake that opened the tomb?
It was an earthquake.
And it was at the time of the crucifixion. And the sun was blotted out, and it was all part of the majesty of God.
Amen. Amen.
So, 27 fifth.
Well, it seems to be, with 51% certainty. You know, I mean,
That's all I can say to you. I don't know. I've never met the man who did. I happen to have been really blessed by our God in heaven with knowing personally some of the finest Bible students of our century. I just happen to be in that position, and I'm really grateful for it. You know, but I've called some men my friend, men that I knew personally, his homes I've been in, his time I've spent with them, you know, who are some of the best scholars of the 20th century, period. Okay? Do they have unanimity of agreement on Daniel 12? No. So I've listened, you know, to these various men's recordings, and each one has a different idea, you know, and so I'm just saying, what do all the candidates have in common? They take place in the generation that Jesus lived in. Every one of them. So, however you work this out, all of Daniel 12 is in the generation that ends with the great tribulation that is nailed down by Jesus. You know from verse 1 what time frame we're talking about. It's the generation in which Jesus lived. So, that's all I can do for you. Let's not go to that slide, but let's read the intervening verses. These are pretty easy. In verse 3, those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So apparently after this resurrection takes place, whatever it is, the earth will still be here, people will still be teaching, they'll be leading others to righteousness. So it's not the end of the planet. Anybody who sees the end of the universe in a final judgment in Daniel 12 is not reading very carefully at all. It's not that. Can't be. Everything about it is a first century fulfillment, and then the earth continues right on. So in verse 4, but as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the time of the end or the end time that, you know, academics and linguists will argue about this endlessly. Many will go back and forth and knowledge will increase. I don't think it's the end of time in the sense of the end of the universe. I think it's the time of the end that's the only end that he's talking about in the end of his book, which is the end of the Jewish people. So then, in verse 5, I, Daniel, looked. Did I miss 4? No. Many will go back and forth and knowledge will increase. I think it's just the work of the gospel as the apostles and others go on down through time, bringing, leading many to righteousness. Down to this day. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others were standing, one on this bank of the river, the other on that bank of the river. One said to the man dressed in linen, remember him from what chapter? That's chapter 10, very reminiscent of Jesus, portrayed in Revelation 1, said to the man dressed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be until the end of wonders? Now David's wondering, Daniel's wondering. He's been flat on his face, near unconsciousness. Needed somebody to give him strength, raise him up. It's a wonderful thing that he's experiencing. So one of these asks the man dressed in linen, how long until the end of these wonders? And I heard the man dressed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, as he raised his right hand and his left toward heaven, and swore by him who lives forever and ever, that it would be for a time, times and half a time. And as soon as they finish shattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed. Does all bear the spelling S-O-M-E? No. Brethren, there's a difference between some when you see some and it means not all. Then there's a difference when you see all, and it means all and not some. How many of the events that have been revealed in the last three chapters are going to take place in a length of time, which is described as time, times, and a half a time, and that ends with shattering the power of the holy people? This ends where? It ends in 70 A.D., and there is no other candidate. It is impossible for it to be talking about anything else. When was the power of the holy people shattered? 70 A.D. What happened to their capital city? It was destroyed. what happened to their temple? Not one stone is left upon another. It's the entirety of Matthew 24. What happened to the records so they could have either a Levitical priesthood or a Messiah from the tribe of Judah? Lost forever. When was the power of Daniel's holy people shattered forever? 70 AD. There's no other candidate. That's the only thing it can be. And that's the furthest terminus on the prophecy. It's not talking about the end of the world. So all the things that it is talking about are fulfilled when the Jews, the holy people, Daniel's people, are destroyed as the chosen people of God. Moses' law is done away. It's replaced by Christianity. Jew and Gentile come together. The dividing wall has been removed. This is what we're talking about as the last thing that happens when all that precedes will be finished. There isn't any other choice. So in Daniel 12, I've already shown you, well, I kind of struggle on the second verse, you know, which resurrection is it, a spiritual one or a physical one? And I've got candidates for both. But are we talking about the end of the world there? No. Because we are told where it all ends, with the shattering of the power of the holy people, which Jesus, of course, in Olivet also is discussing. So, in Daniel 12 and in verse 7, it's time, times, and half a time, and as soon as they finish shattering the power of the holy people, all these events will be completed. So, here, I've just got a quote. I edited it a little bit just to squeeze it onto the page here, but this is from Josephus, Wars of the Jews, in his preface. So it's not even, you know, in the books that follow. It's actually right at the beginning there, in the fourth paragraph. He says, "It had so come to pass that our city, Jerusalem, had arrived at a higher degree of felicity than any other city under the Roman government." That's helpful as well in understanding parts of Revelation and some privileges that the Jews had that no other nation had. Felicity means goodwill and success, you know, everything's going well. So just nobody under Roman rule was doing as well as us. "And yet, at last, fell into the sorest of calamities again. Accordingly, it appears to me that the misfortunes of all men from the beginning of the world, if they be compared to these Jews, are not so considerable as they were." Bill?
What's felicity?
Pardon me? Felicity?
What's felicity?
A felicitous thing is a beneficial thing. It means everything's going well. It's good. Okay? So, this is an eyewitness Jew in the only time frame that Daniel identifies, saying as a hostile witness, because he died a Pharisee, he never accepted Christ, so he hasn't got an oar in the water to try to make it look like Daniel's, you know, foretelling the future. He's just saying, "I saw this, and it was a period of distress that this nation hasn't seen since it was a nation. In fact, in the history of all the world, there was never this." And as a matter of fact, not only Josephus, but virtually every other of your Roman historians of the time and later all agree. And to this day, historians will tell you this event, told in such specific detail by this eyewitness, Josephus, is just horrifying beyond all conception. And it's the end of the Jews. They do never again exist as a people identifiable as the chosen race descended from Abraham. All who claim to be Jews today are Jews in a purely artificial and political sense that has nothing to do with the Bible. They haven't been God's people for 2,000 years. It's just a fact. So now let's read intervening verses again, which are easy, and we'll bring it to a close. You remember, of course, we did all this time, times, and half a time preceding lessons. It's the length of the Jewish war, but that's coming up again. So let's go ahead and read on. In verse 8, "As for me, I heard, but could not understand. So I said, 'My Lord, what will be the outcome of these events?' And he said, 'Go, Daniel. These words are concealed
and sealed up until the end time. Now, once again, out in the denominational world, they pay no attention to context. They don't even care really, it appears, what the words say. It's not saying the end of the world. He said it's when the power of the people were shattered. And so it's during the time of the Roman Empire. It's at that time that ended in Daniel 11. It was the Roman Empire in Jesus' day, that generation. So now he says, I couldn't understand what's the outcome. Well, these are not going to be fulfilled in your lifetime, Daniel. So you conceal it, seal it up. It'll be at the end. What end? When the power of the holy people is shattered. That end. Many will be purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand. Which, of course, is exactly what Jesus said in Matthew 24 as well. Like in the days of Noah, they would not understand that their time of destruction has come. And that's why they would not flee the city with the Christians who did believe that the time had come. So, there'll be both, the wicked and the the righteous. And then we finally come, to the hardest part of this chapter, and comparable only, I suppose, to Daniel 9 for difficulty, and for the same reason. Here we go, numbering stuff again. From the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished, have the Jews had a regular sacrifice today? They have one last week? Have they had one for 2,000 years? When was the last one? 70 AD. And Josephus was an eyewitness and tells us about it. From the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Not weeks, not sevens, not years. Days. How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. So you got 1290 and then 45 more. But as for you, go your way to the end. Then you'll enter into rest. So this is go your way to your end. Go till you die, if I may presume to say so, so that you will sleep in the dust of the earth. Then you'll enter into rest. He'll be dead and waiting. And rise again. He'll come back up, for all I know, in Matthew 27. And your allotted portion at the end of the days. Now that's the only expression that I can find in Daniel that could take us to a final judgment that hasn't yet happened. It'll be after Daniel died. However, if Daniel is one of those raised in Matthew 27, even that last expression would be rooted in the first century with the shattering of the power of the holy people. Either way, it doesn't affect the prophecy itself. Daniel, you're not going to live to see it. So, go and rest. Now, what is that all about? Well, I'll just summarize it all. I pored over Josephus and I went and I was copying and pasting and trying to get, all the relevant passages and everything. Finally, I just thought, well, I'm just not going to do it. It's going to take too much time. So, these are my words. There appear to be 1,290 days from the Roman army's arrival under Cestius Gallus and or Cestius Florus. They were both generals that were involved. They both came in the city, so, we have date problems that we talked about in chapter 9. So, all I'm saying is we know the time frame, it's that generation, and it's one of these guys. Josephus is telling us enough that we know it had to be one of those guys. So 1,290 days from the Roman army's arrival, which is in 66 AD, to the end of the daily sacrifice, which Josephus spends time talking about in detail. Then, after that sacrifice ceased, guess what happens 45 days later? The city falls. 45 days later. Then the temple burns to the ground. But what happened was the Jews, to the stunned surprise of the Romans, Josephus is just amazed. The Jews, he says, they could have never been conquered. He says, suddenly,
unexpectedly, they just surrendered. They just came out of the towers and said, "We give up." And it was over. So, what do we know? We know that while dating is difficult and there's problems in the text of Josephus and all this kind of stuff, that it's very clear. This is the time frame. These are the events. And there is this amount of time. You just have to, you know, adjust like we do. You know, we say circa. So it was this year, that year, and this year, and that year. But the 1290, whether it starts here and ends there, it's shifting with the calendar. So, okay, it was a couple years later. Well, that's 1290 days after that date then. But that's the time. And then 45 days after that, the city fell. So, this is Daniel. What is Daniel? Daniel is truly just one of, if not the preeminently, most staggeringly detailed prophecy in all of Scripture, except for Matthew 24 and Revelation, which is expanding upon Daniel. Daniel's everywhere in Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place. See, then flee to the Judean hills. It's an escapable judgment. So Daniel saw, and Nebuchadnezzar before him, the four succeeding nations that would bring us to the Messiah, and with the Messiah, the end of the Mosaic law, the end of the Levitical priesthood, the end of the temple and animal sacrifice, the coming of Christianity, where those saints will shine like the sun and lead many to righteousness. And we've been doing that now for two millenniums. Sayonara.